Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
We're on a quest to find the greatest number 32s in NFL history, and joining us is historian Joe Zagorski to help us on this journey, and we'll find a top 10 for you coming up in just a moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we're podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So with Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff supplying us with their tunes, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome to a bonus edition of the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch podcast, as we have our Football by Numbers series. In today's edition, we are talking about the greatest number 32s in NFL history, 101 years of NFL history to talk about. And to join us today, because this is a big task with the 32s, we have a lot of stars. We have the famous historian and author, Joe Zagorski. You probably heard him on the Sports History Network. He has his own podcast, Pigskin Past. He's also the author of multiple books, in particular, the NFL in the 1970s. And that's sort of his forte, is that NFL in the 1970s. I know many of us, like myself, grew up in the 70s. And it's exciting to hear somebody talk about some of these stars you grew up watching when you were a kid. And Joe is the expert on that. And we have plenty of those folks today. So why don't we bring them in? Joe Zagorski, welcome to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren, thanks a lot for having me. I think this is the first time I've been on the show. You know, you mentioned 32s. In the 1970s, in the NFL, there were quite a lot of really historic 32 players who wore the number 32 in the NFL in the 1970s. My book about the 1970s in the NFL, if you haven't gotten it yet, you can get it on Amazon or Books a Million or Barnes & Noble websites. That's where you can get it. And it talks a lot about everything that happened from 70 through 79. It's pretty comprehensive. And I think that if, once you read all 444 pages of it, if you have any questions about the 70s after that, you need to call me, because I don't think you'll have any more questions after that. There's so much stuff in there. It's pretty thick. But, you know, you mentioned the numbers 32, and in the 1970s, well, even before that, there is no greater number 32, in my opinion, than Jim Brown.
Definitely.
Pretty much thought of as the greatest player of all time, at least until Jerry Rice came along or Tom Brady. But for a number of decades, he was the greatest player of all time. But in the 70s, you had several other 32s that really grabbed headlines. Of course, O.J. Simpson and Franco Harris. You know, both of those two guys, along with Jim Brown, are in the Hall of Fame for good reason. And O.J. Simpson in the 1970s, he was able to lead the league in rushing 4 out of 5 years. Now, try doing that today. It's really hard to do. But he was able to do that in an era where, you know, the Buffalo Bills, the team that he played for during that time, they didn't have much of a passing game. So he was able to really take a lot of hits and stay, you know, upright enough to be able to gain the yards that he got. And of course, he was the first man to eclipse the 2,000-yard barrier in 1973. And, of course, Franco Harris, he came onto the league in 72, and he was pretty much, you know, kind of like a view of the future. You saw a guy with the body of a Jim Brown, but, you know, you didn't think he was going to be able to run that well, you know, but he was able to gain over 1,000 yards, I think, in each of his first 6 or 7 years. I'm not sure, but he was a great runner. And of course, he became famous, you know, with all the Pittsburgh Steelers dynasty and 4 Super Bowl championships. One thing I noticed, though, there's some 32s that are kind of famous in my mind that played on defense. Mike Curtis, of course, a middle linebacker for the Colts and then later the Seahawks and the Redskins. And Jack Pardee, speaking of the Redskins, who was a famous linebacker for them. Those two guys are pretty famous, and they're 32. But for the most part, it's running backs, as you know. Emerson Boozer from the Jets, Walt Garrison from the Cowboys, they were 32. And, you know, of course, if you ask a Dallas Cowboys fan, they're going to remember Walt Garrison, and maybe Jets fans might remember Emerson Boozer, but I think Cowboys fans will definitely remember Walt Garrison because he did a lot of, you know, ads and commercials during that era as well. But there is one 32 that is either loved or hated. And you can't have both ways with this guy. It's Jack Tatum of the Raiders. Raiders fans love him. And I know Steelers fans hate him. And some other teams do too. He's no longer with us, but he was, and for my money, the hardest hitting safety in the history of pro football. He put people in hospitals. He was one heck of a hitting safety.
You know, you mentioned Franco Harris along with Tatum, and they were both part of probably the most famous play in NFL history, you know, the Immaculate Reception, which I think you alluded to a little bit. Because wasn't it Frenchie Fuqua that caused the ball to go backwards, or allegedly caused it to go backwards? The Raiders fans may argue against that. And, Franco Harris, of course, catching it and going down the sideline for the winning score for that game in the playoffs in the 72 or 73 season.
72. Have you ever seen a controversy last longer than that? I mean, we're talking 40-some years, and they're still arguing about it. I see arguments on like different Facebook pages still today about whether or not Tatum touched the ball last or Fuqua touched it last. You know, if they had today's rules, it wouldn't matter. But back in 72, an offensive player couldn't touch the ball to another offensive player. You had to have a defensive player touch it in between. And that's where Tatum comes in. People believe, the Steelers obviously believe that Tatum touched it before Franco caught it. And so that play will never be forgotten. It's in part of NFL lore. There's an exhibit on it in the Hall of Fame. So it's always going to be remembered fondly or not so fondly by
fans. I don't know if you've ever got off on an airplane at the Pittsburgh airport, but as soon as you get off the plane and you're going down the escalators, there's a picture of Franco in that position of, you know, the ball, you know, inches off the ground, him catching that in a famous bronze statue there. So.
I've seen it. And I've heard people have tried to deface it over the years who are Raiders fans. And a friend of mine also played in that game, Phil Villapiano, and I sent him a picture of it once, and he was upset.
Speaking of Villapiano, have you seen on ESPN Plus? Peyton Manning has a program called Peyton's Places. And I believe it was in season one, he had a whole thing on the Immaculate Reception. And he had Bradshaw and Frenchie Fuqua and Phil V there for the Raiders and Franco Harris. And they talked about the play. Of course, they tried to even Peyton Manning throwing the ball, taking the place of Bradshaw because the guy they had come in just couldn't make that many throws. But they couldn't replicate it. And you know, it was just a hilarious thing. You know, Fuqua had a T-shirt he exposed that said, "I'm never telling," and things like that. It's a really good program.
Well, you know, Peyton Manning, he's a funny guy. And, those segments are just tailor-made for him. He's a very humorous guy, and I get a kick out of watching those.
No, I do too. I didn't realize how hilarious he is. He is pretty funny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but, and there's some other 32s that you had on this list that you sent me that I didn't think about until like a little while longer, and I'm thinking, wow, Stanley Wilson, he wore 32. Tony Galbraith, he wore 32. And there's a few others. Rick Kane from the Lions. These are guys that are not household names, but people who watch football diligently, they'll remember it. Benny Malone, who could forget? Well, I guess a lot of people could forget Benny Malone, but he was Mercury Morris's backup there in Miami, and he had his own distinctive running style, just like Morris did. Pretty interesting. And then, of course, Vernon Perry had one of the greatest playoff games I've ever seen. A defensive back intercepted 4 Dan Fouts passes in a playoff game for the Oilers to beat the Chargers. That was just incredible. I couldn't believe it, that they would throw to, he was a rookie at that time, and they would throw to a rookie that much thinking that they're going to beat him. After the third interception, I would have laid off.
Right. But Fouts was an aggressive passer. You know, he always thought he could stick it in, or just like all the good quarterbacks do, you know, those gunslingers.
That's right. Yeah. And then there's some other 32s. Craig James played for the Patriots for a number of years. And of course, he was part of that Pony Express backfield at SMU with Eric Dickerson. And then Craig became like an ESPN analyst. But he came out of high school, and he was highly touted as like the next greatest phenom. And he was, good enough to make the pros, play for New England. But at that time, New England didn't have a team like they had with Tom Brady on it.
Right.
And then some of these guys are just barely noticeable. I know you have Blair Thomas. People know of him more from what he did in college at Penn State. I honestly couldn't tell you what team he played for in the pros. I just don't even know. So I knew of him more in college. And then we were talking about other defensive players. Dennis Thurman played safety for the Cowboys for a number of years. And he was, he wasn't a superstar, but he was very solid and very dependable. And I think he finished his career with over 20 interceptions, which isn't too bad. And then there's John Keyworth, who played for the Broncos. He was a great running back, at least a good running back, and he was pretty big for the running back size. He was really tall. I think he was like 6'3 or 6'4, which is generally pretty tall for a running back. He was stocky, but back at that time, the Broncos were in a transition period between Floyd Little, who's in the Hall of Fame, and Otis Armstrong, who injuries cut his career short, but those two guys were pretty important to get the Denver Broncos to their first Super Bowl in 1977.
Yeah, I mean, those are some great, great names. And like you said, you don't think about some of those guys, and associate them with the number 32, but there's some great players from that era of football that were the 32. And we haven't even got to some of these guys that are in some of the other decades that are great players too. But I mean, you touched on some of the Hall of Famers. We have 5 Hall of Famers that Canton says were 32 that are in the Hall of Fame. And the first one, Red Bagrow, played long ago, and he only wore it for the 1936 season. And we don't have a whole lot of stats on him. And we've talked about him with some other numbers because he's wore some other numbers that are less than 32. But we talked about,
His first name is Morris.
Is it Morris Bagrow? It could be. I could look it up here real quick. I got the stats here. Oh, yeah, it's Morris Hiram Bagrow, and his nickname was Red.
I could see him sticking with Red.
Right, yeah, I could too. That'd be a lot of names to say there. But he was a New York Yankee, New York Giant, in Brooklyn. So he stayed in the New York area his entire pro career with the different leagues. So
yeah, 1936 is the. The game was a lot different then. Heck, the game was different in the 1970s. So in 1930s, it was way different.
Yeah, definitely. Sure was. They still had the watermelon ball, I think, then too. Didn't they? Or more of a watermelon shape than what we have now.
It wasn't like it is today. I know that.
But you know, the five Hall of Fame members that were 32, you know, beside Fagro, you know, O.J. Simpson, you mentioned, Jim Brown, you mentioned, Franco Harris, Marcus Allen's another one, came in the early 80s, 1982 to 1997, with the Chiefs and the Raiders, just had a, you know, brilliant career. So definitely all those Hall of Famers that we just mentioned. I think, if you're, it's all right with you, I think those four gentlemen, the four running backs I just mentioned, Harris, Allen, Brown, and Simpson, all ought to be on our top 10 list, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I don't know how a person can go from the Raiders to the Chiefs or the Chiefs to the Raiders, but he did it. And so did an assistant coach. He was also a backup quarterback for the Chiefs. And then he went to the Raiders as an assistant coach and then as a head coach for the Raiders. Oh God, what is his name? He just made the Hall of Fame.
Shanahan.
No. He was a Hispanic American. Oh God, I forget his name.
Tom Flores.
Tom Flores, that's it. And so he played for the Chiefs and the Raiders, and so did Marcus Allen. And I'm thinking, well, there's a rivalry there, you know. So I know that it can be done, but I can imagine the ribbing that those two guys must have took going from one of those rivals to another.
Yeah, can you imagine? I mean, Marcus Allen had his first 11 years in a Raiders uniform. And can you imagine that in that first game in 1993 when he was wearing a Chiefs uniform, him going into the Raiders stadium? And I'm not even sure where they were in the early 90s, if they were in L.A. or back in Oakland. They switched around so much back then, I can't remember.
And something else, you know, and it was that way with the Steelers and the Raiders as well. The Raiders made enemies all around the league.
Well, they sort of had, that was sort of their shtick, you know. They wanted to be the bad guys. They had, you know, that silver and black uniform. You know, they had the hard hitters like Tatum and you know, Lester Hayes, and you know, some of those defenders, and you know, very aggressive offensive line. And you know, John Madden, he was a pretty aggressive coach too. So it's,
oh yeah, without a doubt. You know, there's I wish the Raiders would have stayed in Oakland, because, like, I'm a traditional guy, but I understand how the game has to adapt over time and stuff, and you know, it's out of my hands. Certainly, I don't have a say in it, but I'm a traditional guy, and I just wish their teams would have stayed, you know, wherever they were when I was a kid. Like I really wish that the Baltimore Colts would still be the Baltimore Colts. So,
yeah, if the league was as consistent as they are now, like when the Cleveland Browns left to go to Baltimore, you know, they left the Browns name and all their statistics and records in Cleveland.
Right.
That would have been nice if they would have done that with Baltimore Colts, and, you know, the Indianapolis would have had to chose a different name and start over like the Ravens did. That would have been nice.
I agree, and you know, but I don't know why they didn't do it. I guess they probably didn't think enough to do it, but that's a shame.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Okay. Well, I want to mention a couple other 32s that we have here, more of a modern era. You know, Edgerrin James was 32. He wore that jersey for 11 seasons, mostly with the Colts, 1999-2009. Ricky Waters is another one that came in 1992 to 2001, for 10 seasons. Eric Weddle, who I think Eric got done a couple years ago. He finished his career up with the Ravens, but you know, what a great safety he was with the Chargers,
right,
and the Ravens at the end of his career. You know, Devin McCourtney, still playing, a great cornerback lately with the Patriots, but he's wore that number 32 for 12 seasons. Maurice Jones-Drew wore for 8 seasons, you know, mostly with Jacksonville. Otis Anderson's another one, played at the end of the 70s into the 80s, you know, most famously for the Giants. I believe he bounced around a little bit too. But you know, you just keep going on and on. You have all these great names throughout football history that wore it. You know,
it's probably one of the most famous numbers in pro football. I would think, along with number 12, for quarterbacks, it's you know, it's probably not as important as number 12 is, but I think it's, as far as running backs goes, I don't think you'll find a more important number.
Oh, I agree. And I think the bar was set pretty high with when Mr. Brown was running there in Cleveland with it. He sort of made that number what it is.
Yeah, without a doubt.
So, yeah, it's a high standard to live up to. And there's many backs that have got close to it. Not the success he has, I don't think, but got real close.
You mentioned Edgerrin James. I always thought that he was in the Hall of Fame or just got in there recently. I didn't know that he wasn't in it. I might be wrong with that.
Well, you know what? You are correct. Maybe he might be at one in this year, and maybe I missed it. But, yeah, you are right. Edgerrin James is in the Hall of Fame. I'm looking at it right now. So I apologize to Edgerrin and the fans of the Colts here. I have misspoken.
Sure. He'll forgive you, I'm sure.
Well, I think just for that fact, I think maybe he should be our fifth on the list. What do you think?
Well, he'd be the sixth because we keep forgetting Red Bagrow.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. We're going to put him in too. Okay. Yeah. So there's our six. We have four spots open here. Now, you know, we've sent some really good names, but I'm going to rely on you. How about is there a couple of guys maybe from the 70s that you mentioned earlier that we sort of skipped through that maybe you think, you know, maybe should like a Pardee or Curtis or, you know.
I would go with Curtis. I would go with Jack Tatum. I'd go with, won the MVP of Super Bowl 25 for the Giants. Oh, gosh. Otis Anderson.
Okay.
I'd go with him. And let's see if there's any sentimental one here. I have one. I'll go, you know what? He doesn't get enough press, but I'll go with Cullen Bryant, who played for the Rams, and he was a great fullback. I'll go with him.
Okay.
He might
Well, I think those are all pretty good picks there because those are some great players. So our top 10 that we're seeing is we have Cullen Bryant, Jack Tatum, Otis Anderson, Red Badgrove, O.J. Simpson, Jim Brown, Franco Harris, Edgerrin James, and Marcus Allen. That's a pretty good squad right there to have.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of depth there on that lineup.
Yeah, we have a little offense, a little defense. So I think we're just missing a quarterback is all we have. But one of those talented backs, we can just run Wildcat all day, right?
I'd really hate to see what would happen if like a guy like Edgerrin James has to be tackled by a Red Bagrow. I think the red would have to go to a hospital after that.
could be.
Those guys back in the 30s weren't as big and as strong and as fast as those guys in the 80s and 90s were.
Oh, that's for sure. That is for sure. Well, hey, I want to talk a little bit more about your book, you know, because it's really intriguing, you know, that NFL of the 1970s. And what could somebody, if you could just maybe hit some highlights that a listener that's thinking about getting your book, what could they expect in a book like that?
Well, it's a great book for a person that wants to look up things and is a trivia nut. A person who's a trivia nut will love the book. What I did was I took every single year in that decade and I devoted an entire chapter to that year. And I pretty much just scoured almost all these different sources that I could find. I went to the Hall of Fame Research Library and looked for different sources and different articles. I went to NFL Films and looked up different things. And I tried to include as much as I could. Now, it doesn't have everything. There's people that have told me, man, everything's in there. So not everything. I looked it over again. And I forgot a couple of things that I should have put in there that I forgot. But for the most part, it's pretty inclusive as to all that's in there. And I didn't really focus on just the game and the players. I talked about a lot of different aspects of what was going on. For example, in 74, I talked quite a lot about the player strike. It was the first major player strike in the NFL. There was several before it, but this one was the first major one, which had games canceled. And so I talk a lot about that. And then, of course, I also talk about the idea of, you know, steroids in the game in the 70s. It became common, but it wasn't outlawed in the 70s. You could still, you know, do it, and that's why a lot of teams were doing it. And then, of course, I devote a lot of time to the controversial things about the 70s. I take some controversies and hit them head on, like the Immaculate Reception or the Mike Renfro's catch in the 79 AFC title game that was declared out of bounds. He played for Houston and they were playing Pittsburgh, and if you remember it well, every Houston person said he caught it in bounds, and even the announcers, I think it was Dick Enberg and Merlin Olsen, it could have been Kirk Gowdy, they said, oh no, it was a catch. I try to touch on those types of things. But one thing that I wanted to purposefully do is put as many names in the book of players who played so that, they're not forgotten, that at least they could look up their name in an index, in the back index of the book, and see what I said about them and just to prove to their grandkids, yeah, I was in that decade, So... it has a lot in it. It takes a long time to read it because it's a very thick, heavy book. It took me 6 years to write it, so it takes a while to read it. There's a lot in there. I think people will enjoy it, especially if you love football history. If you grew up in the time of the 70s, I think you almost have to have it if you want to relive those days. A lot of people don't realize that, Joe, it's too expensive. Well, I didn't get to say in how much it would cost. I found that out. It's my first book, and I found out the hard way that you don't get a say in it. It's the publisher that does. So, I live and you learn. But I think that I gave people their money's worth with the amount of words in there. I mean, it's pretty thick, and I think you'll like it. There's not a lot of photographs in it, but most of the people, who are buying it, there's, as far as I know, over 1,600 people have bought a copy. But the comments that I've gotten on Amazon have been all positive for the most part. So that makes me feel good. And I think that a lot of people who were around at that time will be able to read things that they long since forgotten and say, I remember that. And so that's what I do.
Well, hey, that sounds like a definitely interesting one. So, make sure you check out Amazon. What's the exact title of it again, Joe?
It's called The NFL in the 1970s, Pro Football's Most Important Decade.
Okay, so make sure you look for that on Amazon. You said Books a Million, and probably almost anywhere you can get books online, I'm sure they'd be able to have it available. Now, before I let you go, I want to make sure we talk about your podcast, The Pigskin Pass, on the sportshistorynetwork.com. You can find that. And I just listened to your latest episode. This will probably be out about a week after that. We're recording on April 6th. But you had a very interesting one on the journeyman quarterbacks. If you could talk about that, and without spoiling anything, we want people to go listen to it. But just the highlights on that.
Yeah, we remember a lot of these famous quarterbacks. Of course, the household names, the Joe Namath, Terry Bradshaw, guys like that. But there's guys that played in the NFL that played upwards of 2, 3, 4, 5 teams. Earl Morrill, who has, I believe, 3 Super Bowl rings, one with Baltimore and 2 with Miami, he played for 6 different teams, so he lived out of his suitcase. there's a lot of guys that have made names for themselves in the NFL as quarterbacks who didn't stay with one team. And, of course, Fran Tarkenton, great Minnesota Vikings quarterback, not a lot of people know that he also played, I believe, 5 or 6 years with the New York Giants. I thought nobody really talks about journeyman quarterbacks that much, so that's why I did that program on them.
It's truly interesting and definitely worth the listen to. Brings back some great memories, all of us that remember that era. And you really bring it to life again and bring that preservation of football history. And that's what we're all looking for and all trying to do. So we appreciate that. And Joe, we really appreciate you spending some time with us today and you know, going through this number 32 list. It's a daunting task, and I appreciate your research and diligence on it and bringing back those great memories. And we hope to have you on again sometime real soon.
Oh, thanks, Darren. Appreciate it. Look forward to it. Take care and have a great rest of your week.
You too. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Bye-bye.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Guardian newspaper circa 1924. But for Marla Delft, assistant editor, everything was about to change. For she was about to discover the awesome attractiveness of Row One brand retro sports paraphernalia items, thanks to Orville Mulligan, sports writer.
And there it is.
Wow, Orville, that's really the bee's knees.
Isn't it just? A poster-sized replica of the actual 1909 World Series program cover.
I can see that. But where did you get it? And where'd you get it framed?
I ordered it from the Row One website, where over 6,000 items of sports memorabilia from the 1880s to the 1990s are available for reproduction in multiple sizes and in several different materials, with over a dozen styles of frame to choose from for prints like this.
Well, I'm sure Mr. Delft would love to put up more of these in the office. But I'm equally as sure they're beyond this newspaper's budget.
Not at all, my dear Marla. See for yourself. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1.
sportshistorynetwork.com/row1. Oh my, these are good prices. Oh, and look at this stuff. Oklahoma-Nebraska football. College basketball art. Michael Jordan items.
And so it was that Marla Delft discovered the splendiferous magic of Row One sports memorabilia arts and prints. You can, too, by visiting sportshistorynetwork.com/row1. That's R-O-W number one today for access to the full Row One catalog of gallery prints and gifts like t-shirts, long-sleeve shirts, telephone cases, coffee mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Act today for 15% discount off all prints with coupon code SHN15 and 20% off all other items with coupon code SHN20 at checkout. And keep your dial locked to the Sports History Network for the exciting chronicles of the 1920 sports world in Orville Mulligan, sports writer, coming soon.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the Official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the Official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.